Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play, which gives you access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a 3-month plan and an annual plan. You'll have access to incredible shows available only on Gaia, like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and Deep Space, and much, much more. Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire TV. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, folks. GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Let's start the show. Out there, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. A quick happy Father's Day shout out to all the fathers and the grandfathers, new and old and soon to be fathers. And that's right, it's me, Cam Hale, and joining me in this canoe, paddling along, keeping the rhythm as we roll along, is Mr. Filio, Kyle Filson, sitting across from me. Kyle, my friend.
Yes, sir.
How was your Father's Day?
It was pretty good. We had a whole bunch of family come over, and we grilled out on the back patio. We had fajitas and tamales, and I had a bunch of Dos Equis, and my brother-in-law showed up, and he brought some Crown Royal with him.
Oh, no.
It was a good time.
Did you eat, like, too much?
I ate too much, yeah. Drank too much, and had a lot of probably laughed too much. It was fun. It's a good night.
My family took me out, or I took them out, rather, and we went and had some sushi, and same thing, had some drinks and laughed and cut up. It was a great, great time. Got some good news. One of my nieces got into a radiology program she was trying to get into, so everything's kind of on the up and up. Everything's flowing along. The heat's on the up and up. And this show is going to be on the up and up, folks. We have a great guest in store for y'all today. We had a wonderful time talking to him. But before we get into that, Kyle, I got something here.
Okay.
You've probably seen it already, but if you haven't, like we've talked about in the past, I had told a story one time about a friend of my dad's who had talked to his grandpa about shooting this funny colored coyote, and then they found this woman later dead, you know, and the whole story how that went down.
I remember that, and yep.
This caught my attention because this is kind of up in there around my wife's family's neck of the woods, but this comes from our homie, old Lon, over at Phantoms and Monsters, and because he actually received this. Now, we've talked to Lon quite a bit off air and through emails and things, especially with what's going on in Chicago, but this is something a little different, folks. This is a large upright, not a wolf, but a coyote in southeastern Oklahoma.
Yeah, so here it goes. It says, hello. I want to report disturbing activity around my residence during the past 2 weeks, and I hope you can give me an idea of what we are dealing with. I live in a rural area of southeastern Oklahoma, a few minutes from Tallahena. I've lived here all of my 48 years and have never experienced anything weird around here before. On June 1st, about 10:30 p.m., I was on my back porch reading the newspaper. My husband was getting ready to leave for work. My porch faces a large wooded area, about 800 feet or so from the lake. I have a small yard, and the edge of the woods is about 50 feet from the house. Now, my husband was walking out the back door, said goodbye, and walked to his truck. And as soon as he pulled away, I heard a loud, shrill sound coming from the direction of the lake. It reminded me of pig squealing, but was much louder and scarier. Well, I didn't get up from my chair as I looked towards the woods, but after a few minutes, I heard something heavy walking through the woods. I was definitely something or someone walking on two legs is what I could think, but it was so dark, I couldn't see anything. And then suddenly, three deer burst out of the woods and ran alongside the house. I thought that they had caused the noise, so I got up and walked into the house. Now, most nights, after I come home from work around 8:30, I eat dinner, then I go out on the porch and read the newspaper. And ever since that first night, I heard the same shrill sound on four other occasions. My husband sat with me a few times, and he was surprised by the sounds. Now, he's been a hunter all his adult life, but didn't have any idea what made those sounds. Well, this Tuesday night, I was sitting on the porch talking to my daughter by phone. My husband was working that night. It was about 10:45 p.m. I had a strange feeling most of the evening, and I had kept my eyes focused towards those woods. I was about ready to get up and walk into the house after ending the call, but then I noticed a pair of bright yellow eyes looking at me from the woods. It was only a few feet into the brush, and the eyes were, well, at least 7 feet from the ground. Well, I ran into the kitchen and quickly closed the door and locked it. I turned the lights off inside, but the porch light was still on, and the edge of the woods was slightly illuminated. Well, as I peeked out of the window just above the sink, I noticed a tall, huge, dark figure standing in the back of the yard. The eyes still shone brightly and were looking in my direction. As I continued to watch, my eyes were adjusting to the low light. I then noticed the long, thick arms with fingers and long nails. I then recognized the long snout and long pointed ears. Suddenly, it turned and ran into the woods. It was gone. I was literally trembling because I had no idea what I just saw. I called my daughter back and told her. My son-in-law and her immediately came over and spent that night, and he brought his rifle with him. The next morning, I told my husband what I saw. He is part Osage and believes in animal spirits. But he was confused by this thing I described. He told me that it may be a trickster spirit, and if we ignore it, it won't bother us. Now, I'm not sure what I believe. This thing didn't look like a spirit, and literally resembled a huge dark coyote walking on two legs. Have you heard anything like this? And if so, please contact me, because I'd like to ask a few questions. And then, of course, you know, we go on, and I had read later that Lon had actually talked to her and some things and did some follow-up on it and trying to figure out what it was, but they haven't seen it and haven't found any more tracks or anything but like
why,
that of it.
Why coyote, not just a dog man? I mean, because a dog man, I mean, a coyote is a type of dog. Yeah. So, I mean.
This is what I'm thinking, given her age and where she lives and all that. She may have never even heard of a dog man.
Right, yeah.
So she described it by, yet again, the only thing she knew. She's may have never seen a wolf. You know, she's probably seen werewolves, but she didn't see anything like this ever before. So what she could relate it to was what she lives by, a coyote.
That's
so
funny.
That's kind of what she went with.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And it's funny that you brought this up because I saw another report on Phantoms and Monsters about an upright walking hyena.
Oh, hell. So now we've got more dogs, coyotes, wolves, hyenas. No, I'm out.
Yeah, check out this. This girl named Amanda emailed Lon and said, my friends and I went to Mexico for a holiday. We rented out a bungalow with some woods and stuff in the back. One time, our friends, while we were there, decided to go out and get more beer and just do some general shopping, and I was left behind to have a shower. after yelling that they were going to double lock the door as they leave. Anyways, the shop was only about 15-minute walk away, and I was literally just going to wash my hair, make a tea, and watch some TV until they got back. About 5 minutes had went by, and I heard a knock on the front door. I thought this was weird, as my friends have keys to this apartment. I just guessed that they were too lazy to use the keys and forgot something. I literally got out of the shower with bubbles still in my hair and was walking towards the door with a towel just wrapped around me. The door had a panel of textured glass in the middle, and I could see this massive entity just standing there. My friends and I are all quite small, and the guys that are with us have blonde hair. This thing looked big and black, and it was very tall. Whatever it was tapping on the door, and I'm standing in the entrance to the kitchen just peeking around the corner. I don't want it to see me, and I slowly crouch down and crawl to the sofa. It was still tapping. After what seemed like ages, it just walked off, and the textured glass is just back to normal. There was nothing on the other side. My friends came back, and Jake just quickly opened the door and goes, "Oh my God, Amanda." We were walking back, and we turned off the road, you know, where our room is, and we saw this massive thing. It looked like a hyena. That's all I can describe it as, only it was walking on two legs. So what do you think about that? In Mexico, I've been to Mexico numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
I got married in Mexico. A hyena? First of all, you know, they're from Africa. So what the heck is it doing in South America? And what was it doing walking on two legs and tapping? And she didn't just see it herself. So it wasn't like she hallucinated, got some soap in her eyes and thought she saw a hyena through the glass door. Her friend saw it too down the road. Was it somebody dressed in some kind of costume trying to pull a prank? I don't know.
I don't know.
Go into a lot of details.
You remember the Island of Dr. Moreau?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, with Val Kilmer and... I see his face, but I can't.
Yeah.
Marlon Brando,
yeah. You remember Hyena Swine?
No.
That's the main evil character, was like the half-breed.
Okay.
He's the one I remember because he goes, "There is no pain, there is no law." You remember that's where he had tore out his little shocking device, and he was the guy bringing the problem. Every time I think of hyenas, and like now that you brought up like up, I think of that thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That upright hyena guy. It's like the island. What if a lot of this is like the Island of Dr. Moreau here? Maybe what if they're escaped? What if it was something that they got Montauk Chronicle style and now they're loose and running around down here?
Yeah, right.
How crazy would that actually be if that stuff was real? You know what I mean? Mm-mm. I am out on the whole idea. I don't want to see upright coyotes. I don't want to see upright hyenas. I don't need to see all this. And don't they have like one of the strongest jaws of any animal on like dirt? I don't mean like in the ocean, but I'm talking like, because I know they can crush like elephant leg bones with their jaw.
And I don't think most people that realize how big hyenas are. They think they're just like a big dog. They're ginormous.
Big faux penises on them and all that stuff.
Yeah, they are bizarre.
Dude, they're just
bizarre animal.
Very, very bizarre. I've got you something because I know how much you love ancient history, and as much as I love ancient history, this was reported in the Siberian Times. You can find it all over. This is very, very interesting to me. They believe that they used, you know, we were always talking about how did they do these carvings. You know, you always want to think about knives or you want to think about, okay, they napped out flint and they used like a spearhead or carving. And that you could think about that with that flint like a rock. It would take a lot of work to really sit there and do some of these carvings. So you're thinking, well, how would you go about even starting this whole thing? But if you were living in the wild and you had witnessed something, and the thing you witnessed was something using its teeth to carve through wood, like a beaver, you would think it would give you an idea. The article reads, "Beaver's teeth used to carve the oldest wooden statue in the world."
That makes sense, though. Like, if you're observing an animal in the wild, you know, gnawing through trees, and you find some beaver teeth, you're like, well, I'll try to use these.
Or you
these.
Kill it to eat it, and you're like, well, I can just use this for it.
Too. Yeah, makes sense.
Dating back 11,000 years with a coded message left by ancient man in the Mesolithic age, the Shigir idol is almost three times as old as the Egyptian pyramids. And there's new scientific findings suggest that images and hieroglyphics on the wooden statue were carved with the jaw of a beaver, its teeth still intact. Now, originally dug out of a peat bog by gold miners in the Ural Mountains in 1890. It says here that this is remarkable. Now, folks, look it up because it is awesome. It's a seven-faced idol, and it's now in Yekaterinburg. It's in a glass sarcophagus on display, wherever this place is at. But 2 years ago, these German scientists dated this idol back to 11,000 years. And at a conference, now there were some international experts there this past few weeks ago that they were talking about this. And there's a professor, Mikhail Zilin, and he was talking about this wooden statue. Now, originally, it's 5.3 meters tall, and it's made of larch. And it says with the basement and head carved using silicone faceted tools is what they're talking. And this is what he says. The surface was polished with a fine-grained abrasive, after which the ornament was carved with a chisel. At least three were used, and they had different blade widths. The faces were the last to be carved because apart from these chisels, some very interesting tools. So he knew that it was the last of how it was done, made of halves of beavers' lower jaws. He also said that beavers are created to carve trees, is what, you know, he talks about. And if you sharpen a beaver's cutter teeth, you get an excellent tool that is very convenient for carving concave surfaces.
I need a beaver tooth knife.
Right? Exactly. Right. To sit there. It's crazy to think of this, but he said that studying the idol, that he believed the tool is consistent with its markings. And he talks about these other things, that they've been making holes with them. Now, Svetlana Panini, a head of the archaeological department of Savorsk Regional Local History Museum, said that this was the example in this thing of making the holes in this statue were used by one of these other alternate beaver jaws, basically, is what they were using this thing for. And that the idol was put on a stone stand, you know, like a basement. It wasn't dug into the ground. It was actually built and then put upon stone to be even higher. And they said it stood on wherever they put this for around 50 years by this body of water. 50 years weathered before it fell off into it and was later covered up by all this peat. So basically it was a time capsule that, right, that saved this whole thing.
Sealed.
It was sealed off before they ever found it. Now, he said that he is previously, this is the guy, the Zilin. Now, he's a researcher for the Russian Academy of Sciences Institute of Archaeology. And he talks about his feeling of awe whenever he started studying this whole thing because it's more than twice as old as Stonehenge. He said, so it kind of blew him away. But he said that this is a masterpiece and it carries gigantic emotional value and force with it. That it's a unique sculpture, and there is nothing else like it in this world. It's very alive and very complicated at the same time. The ornament is covered with nothing but encrypted information, and people were passing on knowledge with the help of this idol. So he goes on to say, and it's really interesting, because one of the seven faces, only one, is a three-dimensional face that's on it. It says, while the message remains an utter mystery to modern man, it was clear that its creators lived in total harmony with the world and had some sort of advanced intellectual development and a complicated spiritual world. So the way it almost reads is, if you think about it, when I was reading this and looking at the pictures, if you would imagine this is kind of the way, I know it's silly, the old signs that have like the arrows pointing, it's 700 miles to New York, and it's this far to here, and it's this far to here, you know, and they put them out in the middle of nowhere, so you know what roads to go on. What if that's what this was used for?
Right.
If this was like a basic old school street sign, that it was put up to tell you who the kings of this land were or who was the rulers of this area and how far it was from everywhere. Or what if it was just a well-wishing thing where you, when you went, you know, it was just because the way it was found and nothing else out there around it was almost suggest that it was basically placed out in the middle of nowhere, almost like the Georgia Guidestones. You know, it was placed out there by themselves, and it was out there just to have this information on it.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But it was carved with a beaver's jaw.
Man, that's...
Multiple beaver jaws.
Right. That's very interesting. Also interesting, this was posted by Roger Marsh over at Open Minds. It's an article about how military jets were seen chasing a UFO. This a Georgia witness reported watching a group, they say, of military jets that appeared to be escorting or chasing a red-orange sphere around 600 feet in altitude. The witness says they were outside stargazing in his backyard with a telescope at around 10 p.m. on February 21st, 2017, when the incident occurred. He said, I first heard low-speed jet engines just north of me. I turned to see what it was, and I saw a row of flashing white strobe lights with a reddish-orange ball or sphere in the middle coming towards me, moving real slow. Now, the witness watched this as six fighter jets flew overhead at approximately 500 feet. He said one jet was approximately 500 feet to the west of this reddish-orange sphere, or whatever this was. Another jet was approximately 500 feet to the east of the reddish-orange sphere, and four more jets were side-by-side following about 1,000 feet behind the reddish-orange sphere. What was so strange about it was how low and slow they were all flying, and they flew directly over the top of me. Now, this reddish-orange sphere looked to be about 30 feet in diameter. It was kind of dim with no strobe lights of any kind. After they flew over, the jet on the west side of the sphere backed off, turned left, and got right behind the sphere. After that, I couldn't see them anymore because of the trees that are around 1 mile south of me. As far as I could tell, they all kept flying straight south. Now, if they should have been flying to the southeast, they would have been going towards Moody Air Force Base. I don't know of any airport that was straight south of me, but I don't know where they were going. So to this day, I don't know where I saw. So what do you think of that? That's bizarre. It sounds to me like they were escorting a UFO. This is another reason why sometimes I think it's, I mean, I guess it's truly a UFO, but maybe we've developed some kind of crazy drone that they're testing and that these planes are flying. They're escorting it somewhere. They're doing some kind of test. Maybe it's not really an orb. Maybe the light you saw looked like an orb, but there was a, you know, because it's at night. He's stargazing in the telescope. Could the shape of the object be different? And what looks like an orange sphere is actually just an orange light that's on whatever this object is, a drone. Who knows? But I find it very interesting. And the reason I brought this up is because of the guest we're having on today. We're going to be speaking with our friend Nick Redfern about his new book, The Roswell UFO Conspiracy, Exposing a Shocking and Sinister Secret. Well, on this day's show. Now, if you don't know who Nick Redfern is, if you've been living under a rock, he's a very prolific writer. He's a full-time author. He's a journalist specializing in a wide range of unsolved mysteries, including Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, UFOs, government conspiracies, alien abductions, and basically all types of paranormal phenomena. He writes regularly for the London Daily Express newspaper. He writes for Tea and Times, Fate Magazine, UFO Magazine, as well as many others. And he himself has been all over the world investigating reports of lake monsters, whether in Scotland, vampires in Puerto Rico, werewolves in England, aliens in Mexico, and sea serpents in the United States. He travels and lectures exclusively around the world and has been on numerous television shows, including everyone's favorite, Ancient Aliens. And he's appeared on our show probably 5 or 6 times. He's a good friend of ours. He lives really close to Skeleton Studios. Normally we have him in studio, but he was tied up filming another show and he was only able to call in. So I hope everybody enjoys this interview. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we're going to be talking with Nick Redfern. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Alrighty, folks, it is about to go down. This is a little bit different. We procrastinated. It's Kyle and I's fault. We procrastinated. We were going to have our special someone in studio with us, and we put it off too long. We didn't wait in the last minute. We can't get him in studio. But normally, sitting to my direct left is the man on the phone with us right now, Mr. Nick Redfern. Nick, how are you doing, my friend?
Hey guys, I'm doing good, thanks. Yeah, it would have been cool if I could have come down. It was what it was, though. I had to do a pre-record show from 6:15 to 6:45, so there just wouldn't have been time for me to sort of then, you know, race down, unfortunately. But that would have been cool, because, you know, it's good just kind of hanging out in your studio, you know.
Yeah.
Cool evening or whatever.
We'll get you in here. We'll get you in here next time. We'll get it all together. And like we were laughing about off air, Nick's been pumping out books. He's been working like crazy. Works his fingers to the bones, folks, to give us some enjoyment, some entertainment, and to dig into these stories. So today, the story that we're going to dig into with Nick is his new Roswell book. Now, before everybody gets all carried away and goes, look, I'm turning this off. I don't want to talk about Roswell anymore. You got to understand it's this. It's the Roswell UFO Conspiracy, Exposing a Shocking and Sinister Secret. That's the one Nick's been working on. Now, before we even jump into that, we got to lay the groundwork to understand where we're coming from, or where Nick was coming from with this. roughly 10 years ago, I would say, when it 10 years ago, it was 10 years ago, wasn't it, Nick? 2005, right?
12 years ago, yeah.
12 years ago, you wrote a book called Body Snatchers in the Desert. And that book kind of got you a little hate and a little heat. Now, Nick doesn't shy away from this, and it's happened before in a lot of his theories and a lot of books he's written. But this one kind of put him on the spotlight. And if you would, Nick, for those of you that aren't aware of what's going on, this might be an angle from Roswell that you've never heard of and that you were completely unaware of, but it's extremely interesting. And the paper trail that Nick has that leads to all of this is really, really mind-blowing in my opinion. So, Nick, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you kind of discuss where you built it and how you come to this.
Well, what happened was that back in 2001, I got the first sort of strands of a story from an elderly woman who worked at the Oak Ridge Atomic Energy Installation in the 1940s. And she said she wanted to tell me a story that was related to the UFO subject, which in an odd way it was. I assumed she wanted to talk about a UFO event or events, but that isn't what she wanted to talk about. She said that she knew the truth of Roswell, and it was much darker and disturbing than the idea that aliens crashed outside of Roswell. And what she said was that between late 45 through 46 into 47 and then tailing off in late 47, although she did hear rumours of a couple of experiments later, that what was going on was a great deal in New Mexico of high altitude exposure experiments, not so much early programs involved in the space program, but what would ultimately lead towards the early years of the space program. So this involved launching massive balloons high into the skies of New Mexico, essentially with what we would call human guinea pigs on board, to determine the effects of things like high altitude exposure, exposure to the very highest fringes of the atmosphere, cosmic rays, things like that. And really, as I said, to determine the effects, because back then the effects weren't really known too well. And she told me that a number of these experiments failed, and these massive balloons, in a couple of cases, exploded just due to the sheer heat. And from there, the balloon materials crashed to the ground, the craft came down, the crews were killed. And she said that one of these occurred on a ranch just outside of Roswell. And, of course, then I realized she was talking about the Roswell case. And she said that she knew for 100% certainty that the Roswell crash UFO legend was based on these highly classified massive balloon flights with the human subjects on board. And she put me in touch with several other old-timers from the military and the intelligence community who essentially told the same story that she did. And when I'd got sort of five or six sources and corroborative material and things like this, I wrote the book that you mentioned, Body Snatchers in the Desert. And excuse me, essentially, it told the story of how I came to write the book, why I wrote it. And of course, the big issue with Roswell is that it's ufology's number one case. It's the sacred cow of ufology, or as I call it, Saint Roswell. And it's one of these situations where for most people, Roswell, it's like you don't screw with Roswell because this is our number one. But the more I dug into this story, the more and more I was convinced that this wasn't disinformation, that I wasn't being lied to, that I wasn't being fed a line, that this was the answer. Even if, like for every explanation for Roswell, we don't have definitive proof. Now, of course, when the book came out, as we were saying just before we went on air, it kind of tagged me as the next worst thing to like Saddam Hussein, how dare Nick say this, and he's being got at by the men in black. That was something that cropped up like several times. I said, no, the men in black haven't got at me. It's just I've changed my views based on new data. That really all what it was. And back then there was this online discussion chat group list called UFO Updates, which had hundreds of members. And every morning I'd get up, you know, and check out UFO Updates, and there'd be sort of another 20 or 30 comments from people that I had to respond to. But, you know, I enjoy a good argument, and if it gets heated, that's fine as well. You know, and if somebody wants to get in my face, well, they better not, you know.
Yeah.
So that was basically the origins of that particular book, the idea that for those who sort of want the backstory, what happened at the end of the Second World War was a lot of German scientists were brought over from Germany, obviously, who were experts in rocketry under a program called Operation Paperclip. And Paperclip was a sort of clandestine, highly secret program where to try and prevent the Russians from getting the German scientists, and the big concern was, you know, if they did, then they might beat us in the arms race and even the atomic race. So it was a case of having to sort of do a deal with the devil. You know, we have no love for these German scientists, but if we don't grab them, the Russians surely will.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as that, the Japanese were building or working on, in the final closing stages of the Second World War, these gigantic balloons. And some of their scientists were brought over to continue the designing and building these massive balloon arrays, reportedly one of which came down at Roswell and was responsible for this huge debris field of foil-like materials. And so you had the scientists brought over, you had from Japan and Germany, you have their sort of blueprints for advanced rocketry and things like this. And this was all going on in New Mexico in 45, 46, 47 and so on. And from there, there was the issue of secrecy. And the secrecy, I was told, didn't so much revolve around the technology that was involved, but the fear of what the public would say if it was found out that a deal had been done with the Germans and the Japanese just a short time after we'd finished fighting them, essentially. So it was really the nature of the controversy surrounding the experiments rather than the experiments themselves. You know, we weren't talking about anything, any kind of advanced technology. It was sort of glider-type aircraft attached to these giant balloons. So it wasn't like we're talking about them flying futuristic UFO-type devices around New Mexico, nothing like that. So that was essentially the whole story, you know, sort of condensed down. And since that book came out in 2005, you know, over the years, further people would come along, but not just to me, to other people, other researchers as well, like Leonard Stringfield, Keith Basterfield, Popular Mechanics magazine, they got the story too. So I was able to put more and more sources together, and finally, in the latter part of last year, I was able to sort of start writing the book on the subject as a sequel, because up until then, there just wasn't enough new material. So that sort of leads now into the new book, which has just been out about 3 weeks, called The Roswell UFO Conspiracy, which sort of doesn't sort of leave off into where the other book finished in terms of the story, but it just provides an entire book of new sources for the same scenario, sort of bolstering, you know, the original claims.
It's a fascinating, I think, the thing for me is this, is given the time that this all took place, it's one of the ideas of taking someone that didn't want to go, you know, completely against their will, and using them in some clandestine military experiment is hard for people to wrap their heads around. I know people have a hard time even when we bring up and we all discuss the Montauk Chronicles and the Montauk experiments and all the things that went on. This thing, though, is it's not like they were taking people that had family or they were taking people that might possibly have been missed. This seems to be more along the lines of them taking people out of, I mean, brought up asylums or hospitals or things. These are people that they knew there was no more paper trail. And so they could just go and use them.
Sorry, go on. Yeah.
Well, they could just go and use them whenever they really felt like it. And when they were done with them, they were just like an expendable thing. It was like going down to the pet store and buying a hamster. I mean, when they were finished with it, they were finished. That was it.
Well, yeah, that's what it came down to. And one of the sort of intriguing things is that actually some official documents that confirm this have been released, not in relation to Roswell, but I'll just explain the ones that have now surfaced. Back in 1991, President Clinton initiated this program to investigate unethical radiation experiments undertaken from the 1940s onwards. And a lot of those files, literally thousands of pages, have surfaced, not on Roswell, but there are some declassified files now, which you can find at the National Archives in Maryland and actually read the originals there. They talk about doing deals with prisoners in American prisons to take part in experimental aircraft flights in return for lessening their sentences. So, you know, we have proof now that that was going on. That's not hearsay or rumor. Those files are widely available now at the National Archives. So, you know, there is a precedent. This isn't connected directly with Roswell, but it does show that deals were done with people who essentially wouldn't be missed and told, you know, you take part in this experiment. Okay, it's going to be dicey and dangerous, but when you, you know, if you survive it and you come out of it, you got 5 years knocked off your sentence, or you walk free, you know, even better from their perspective. So, you know, we know these kind of experiments and these deals were made. And as you said, they were made not specifically because they wanted people from hospitals or prisons or asylums. It was done because, as you said, those people wouldn't be missed. You know, grabbing 10 or 15 people off the streets of New Mexico, word's going to soon get out. And of course, back then, unfortunately, there was a great deal of stigma, you know, against sort of people with psychological conditions, mm-hmm. psychological illnesses and physical handicaps as well. You know, people, you know, they didn't talk about it that often much, you know, and people, unfortunately, were placed in asylums and left there, you know, and it was sort of the family secret nobody wanted to talk about. And thankfully, we've got past that today. But back then, you know, things were very different.
And it shouldn't be that surprising that their government would do something like that, I don't think, because, I mean, I've seen videos of U.S. soldiers marching towards the atomic bombs being detonated. We know that years later, almost all those people died early from cancer, Agent Orange being dropped on people in Vietnam. I mean, so if you're willing to expose American GIs to such terrible things, I mean, of course you would. If you're working on some top secret military project, I don't think it's out of the question to, like you're saying, go to asylums and sanitariums and stuff, or go to prisons and ask for volunteers. I mean, that seems totally plausible. Also, Nick, do you know anything? I read one time about how they were not just using prisoners and people with mental disabilities, but people with physical disabilities, like, you know, I don't know what the correct term is, dwarfism, small people. And
well, again, yeah, there were reportedly some of the experiments involved people who were, you know, physically had genetic issues and things like this. And again, they weren't deliberately, you know, using, say, for example, someone who had a, you know, a dwarfism condition. There was no need for them to do that beyond the fact that, again, there were people back then who wouldn't be missed, you know. And I was told that, you know, some of these experiments, when they fail badly and they crash to Earth, and in some cases, you know, the bodies were badly damaged, the military who were, you know, recovering this material, because these programs were highly classified, the detachments that went out to recover these things weren't actually told what they were recovering, because they wanted to keep the number of people in the know of what was really going on to a minimum. So if you imagine you're a 19-year-old soldier, and you and all your colleagues and friends are ordered to head out to a particular site in the desert, and you find this, you know, this exploded balloon debris all over the place and this battered craft, and you see two small bodies laying outside of it in sort of like, you know, a pilot's jumpsuit, that kind of thing, you can 100% easily understand why that could provoke like a crashed UFO legend. So in other words, it was the fact that, you know, in some cases they were using physically handicapped people, etc., that led to, you know, some of these legends of the alien bodies out in the desert, that kind of thing. So, you know, it was a controversial period. I mean, I'll give you another example, you know, where I'm from, England. A few years ago, the British government declassified a huge batch of files on a place called Porton Down, which is where the British government does all its research into like viruses and biological warfare and chemical warfare. And the files show that in the early 50s, staff at Porton Down secretly and without their knowledge dosed a bunch of British soldiers with LSD and various other mind-altering substances and chemicals and filmed them just to see how incapacitated or not they were by these various biological agents and chemicals. And some of the troops were really badly affected, and you know, they had flashbacks in later life, and you know, it affected them psychologically. And you know, that's kind of like another example of how this kind of thing has gone on. So you know, we're talking about a very short period of time, not something that went on. And it seems to be the case that these Japanese and German scientists were sort of given free rein to do what they wanted to do. And then when the sheer scope of it became known to, you know, the government and the higher-ups, it was, no, we've got to stop this. You know, this has crossed the line now. But there were some people who felt that crossing the line was the only way to get the results about, you know, high altitude exposure, the cosmic rays, things like that. The only way to do it was to, you know, have these experiments, even though they realized they had crossed the line. But reportedly, it was all shut down, which is why, according to the people I interviewed, there was sort of like a flurry of reports and legends of crashed UFOs in the late 40s, but then not so many at all through the 50s and 60s onwards. You know, it was, people often wonder, why did they all come down in the 40s? But if you look at it from a secret experiment angle, that would offer a good explanation, you know.
Yeah, and geographically, I mean, where it crashed is, you know, really close to Los Alamos, where, you know, when they were doing the testing, that would have been the place and area to do the test, way out in the middle of nowhere.
Well, you're right. I mean, that's an important thing that a lot of people forget, is the location where a lot of these crashes occurred, namely New Mexico. Now, Los Alamos was one of the primary installations in the 40s, which was involved in the development of the atomic bomb. Now, you'd also got Alamogordo, the military base there, where reportedly, you know, a lot of classified aircraft and devices were tested from there. And we certainly know that a huge amount were tested from White Sands, which is also in New Mexico. And White Sands is to where a lot of the German paperclip scientists were sent to do their work. And so when you put all those together, and then you have the issue of Roswell itself, the military base, as it was at the time, the Roswell Army Airfield, because this was before the Army and the Air Force split into two when Roswell happened. But the Roswell base itself was home to the 509th Wing, and the 509th were the guys who flew the missions to bomb Japan, which with the nuclear weapons, which ended the Second World War. So in other words, you can take UFOs out of the equation, and at Roswell, you know, with the atomic bomb wing, Los Alamos, Alamogordo, White Sands, take UFOs and classified human experiments out the mix, and you've still got a massive amount of secrecy and advanced technology going, being tested. I mean, even before these reported human flights, you know, that we know there were flights that began with like mice and then rats and chimpanzees, monkeys, even in some flights, pigs. And then it was after that that somebody, we don't know who, said, well, you know, we've got to take this to the next stage. We've got to have human test subjects, but how do we get them? And that's when you have the developments of this sort of very dark aspect of, you know, the history of it all.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, where it took place, when it took place. And, you know, we know if they were using small people in this craft that was at high altitude, because I don't think people realize elevation, altitude can really cause some bizarre effects on a human. I mean, it may have made their head swell up, their limbs swell up, their fingers. And as you see a burnt and charred small body that's been deformed because of the effects of altitude. And like you were talking about, you're just a 19-year-old GI doing your job as a recovery agent. You might think that you saw an alien. That it just makes sense to me. And also,
yeah,
not just the case. It wasn't like when you were doing your research, you found one case like this. I think I remember reading that there was a fella, even all the way in Australia, and his father kind of had the same story. It fits right in line with what the woman had found. Is that correct?
Well, This was a guy named Keith Basterfield, and Keith is a well-respected UFO researcher who lives in Australia. And what's important is that when Body Snatchers came out in 2005, in the summer of 2005, because the publisher, Simon & Schuster, because it's a controversial story, everything was kept under wraps, you know, don't tell anybody, we'll just put the book out. So Keith didn't know anything about the book. In fact, nobody other than me and the publishers, you know, a small, tight number of the people in the publishing house knew about it. Now, when the book came out, Keith read it, and he thought, well, hang on a minute, this story is just like one that I was given way before. And so Keith contacted me, and he said, hey, Nick, you know, I've read your book, very interesting. I thought you'd like to know that way before your book came out, I was given the same story, but from a guy whose father had emigrated from the UK to Australia and worked in British intelligence. And he told Keith an almost identical story, even down to the idea, you know, this gigantic balloon with this detachable aircraft device and the handicapped people and how they had to grab them from, you know, like a facility, you know, a hospital-type facility. All of the main points were there. Now, on top of that, Popular Mechanics, they published a story saying they'd been given the same story about a Japanese and German paperclip-type program that would explain Roswell. And they were told that documents were going to surface. Now, these documents ultimately didn't surface, obviously, otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be talking about it now. But they said they were told by sort of insiders that somebody was trying to get the story out, and it would not be a story of aliens at Roswell. It would be a story of paperclip and the human experiments, etc., etc. And when I look back into some of the earlier works of people like Leonard Stringfield, who died in 94, he made a brief aside in a 1991 report, which I'd actually hadn't seen at the time, to where he'd been told about certain experiments going on with Japanese people who were handicapped out at Los Alamos in the mid to late 40s. So, you know, if it had just been me that was being given this story, I would have been very suspicious, as if I'd been targeted, you know, by disinformation people. But the fact that this story had been quietly told to various people around the world across decades, that sounds far more plausible than a disinformation program just deciding to target one or two people, you know.
Yeah, I've also read, do you know anything about where, I heard a theory one time where it wasn't even something of ours, it was perhaps a high-altitude balloon that the Japanese were testing, where they were trying to float these balloons by using the jet stream and float a atomic weapon over here to fall on America, and that's what they crashed, and that's why it was so top-secret, is the government swooped in, they wanted to gather up all that stuff and see exactly what the Japanese were up to. You know, they were trying to reverse-engineer what they were up to. Have you heard of that theory?
Well, that does actually kind of tie in with the book, because all the people I interviewed said that the Japanese were building or planning to build these massive balloons in the final stages of the Second World War. Then, of course, when the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, the war came to a sudden end then. The Japanese just, surrendered, because the alternative was like the systematic entire destruction of Japan. You know, that's what they were staring at in the face. But what happened was that they were working on these gigantic balloons. Now, in the Second World War, they did have these balloons called Fugo balloons, F-U-G-O, which were smaller ones, which had bombs attached to them. And they would go across the jet stream. And, you know, the idea was that they would come down in the United States and, you know, the bombs would explode and kill people. Fortunately for all the, you know, for the people who were around then, the program didn't work too well. But they, as I said, they did have plans to build these much bigger balloons that would be manned. They would have like a gondola below them, like a sturdy, solid gondola, pressurized, etc. And the story was that they actually were training crews of relatively small guys, like 5 feet tall, because weight and height were a premium when you're flying balloons across the across the Pacific. And so what I was told was that the guys, some of the crew were even brought over and took part in some of these experiments. They were given kind of this you know, this offer that you can't refuse, you know. And so they were brought over, the scientists were brought over, the blueprints for these massive balloons were brought over, and were actually kind of inserted into the balloon programs that were already going ahead here. So in other words, what you're talking about is actually part of the story. Now, the idea of, you know, of a Japanese atomic bomb, you know, we know that didn't happen, but it is a fact that you know, they were planning to fly these balloons over. And there are actually a few rumors that in 43 or 44, there were a couple of these huge balloon flights to the United States, which actually made it to the US. John Keel, for example, in Fate magazine, in 1991 and again in 1993, he published articles talking about how he'd spoken to people who had living in the California desert, who'd seen this large balloon coming from, you know, obviously the Pacific Ocean area across California at a great height. And then as it got over the California desert, it started to come down and crashed. And that when they got out there, what they were expecting, you know, to see American people on there. But what they saw were like several Japanese people, relatively short, who jumped out of the gondola, what was left of it, and sort of, you know, headed for the hills, so to speak. And in no time, the military was on the scene. Now, that, you know, could have been perceived as an early crashed UFO, you know, relatively small people, this huge balloon-looking thing, like a sphere. You can easily see how that could have been sort of assumed to have been a UFO years later. But Keel said he spoke to these people directly and personally, and they were told by the military, look, you won't talk about this. We cannot let the public know that the Japanese have actually successfully made a couple of manned balloon missions to the US. And the story was that it was, again, for morale reasons. You know, they didn't want, even if there were just two balloon flights and, you know, they didn't work too well, and the military managed to grab the pilots quickly and it was all hushed up, you can understand how it could affect morale, you know, if the newspapers reported, you know, Japanese troops reached California, that kind of thing. So it does actually tie in very closely with what you're talking about with the Japanese balloons.
Yeah, it makes sense because, like, you know, when Mac Brazel found some of the debris, and I remember he took it over to show the Proctors, you know, maybe some of the strange writing or hieroglyphics they were claiming were actually just Japanese letters, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the theory that, you know, was put to, well, not the theory, but the answer that was put to me, that the hieroglyphics were actually Japanese writing. And, you know, when you look at the debris field that people talked about seeing, which, you know, everybody, even the Air Force, you know, admits that there was this huge field of debris, but they believe it was from a Mogul balloon, which was like a gigantic balloon array to spy on the Russians and to try and determine if they were testing atomic weapons. So you have this huge field of what actually does sound like a, you know, a gigantic balloon that exploded and showered down, you know, the foil-like materials everywhere. And then at a second place on the ranch, you have a semi-intact vehicle, which was the vehicle attached to the giant balloon, which could be detached and sort of glide back to Earth, so to speak, which is one of the things they were researching back then. You know, the idea of launching these craft in these gigantic balloons to the highest levels, you know, and then they would sort of glide back down and land. But in this case, they didn't. You know, there's a mishap and the balloon exploded and everything came down. Then you have a third site where at least a couple of the bodies were reportedly blown out as this craft spiraled down, which often happens in like aircraft crashes, unfortunately, you know, that's very often be grisly, but very often bodies are found, you know, half a mile from the crash site because they get blown out of the aircraft, you know, on the way down. And so when you look at it like that, that would explain the three sites. It would explain why at one site there's all this weird foil, because that would be blown down in one particular area by the winds, and it would be very light material, whereas the craft would just plummet down vertically because it's so heavy. So that would explain two definitively different sites and different materials at the two sites. And there are rumors that Brazel, Matt Brazel, the rancher, may have actually seen one or two of the bodies, along with a young boy who helped him at the ranch named Dee Proctor. And they were both reportedly told, you know, you will never talk about this ever, you know, and put the fear of God into both of them. Brazel died young in 63, and Dee Proctor became like a full-on alcoholic and recluse and would not talk to anybody ever about Roswell. He was like living in a state of almost like post-traumatic stress, you know, until he died in his early 60s.
There's something to that whenever somebody withdraws that much, whether it's something that he saw it being what he considered to be real people, or if it was something that he believed to be extraterrestrial.
Yeah, he may not have known. Brazel may not have known. You know, I mean, the one important thing that many people forget is that we know that there was at least one day, possibly two, between Brazel finding the debris and the military, because in the worst case scenario, what happened was that because this was a night flight and it went wrong, nobody in the military was actually sure where it had come down. So they were, you know, they were frantically looking for the remains of this balloon and this craft, which, you know, wouldn't have taken up much space, so it'd be hard to miss it. The worst case scenario, the ranch of Brazel got there, because it was his property, before the military. So what happened was that you know, Brazel was sort of scouting around the area, wondering what all this was. So in worst case scenario, or best case for the military, if he just found the balloon materials, they could have told him, well, it's just this balloon we're flying, a bigger one than normal, that's why it looks odd, don't worry about it. And that probably would have laid it to rest. But from the military's worst case scenario, he stumbled across a couple of the bodies, which looked very strange looking, and decaying from, you know, the hot New Mexico sun in the summer of 1947. And, you know, there's no way you can write off the bodies as just being, oh, you know, we just tested a huge new balloon. When he saw these small bodies and possibly handicapped bodies, he realized this was something more. And that's what potentially and almost certainly led to, you know, this sort of almost over-the-top series of threats that you will never, ever talk about this, ever.
I don't know, Nick. I saw that alien autopsy movie, and it didn't look like a small Japanese guy.
Well, no, he didn't.
I'm sure, I mean...
But, you know, I mean, joking aside, when that came out, a number of people did point out that, although, you know, later it was proven, although some people still believe it's real, although it was sort of pretty much shown to not be genuine, some of the characteristics of that body were very similar to a very rare condition called progeria, which is like an aging disease. If you Google progeria, P-R-O-G-E-R-I-A, and click on images, you'll see the head looks, and the body looks, not unlike a person with progeria. They have, you know, as I said, it's called it's like an aging disease. It's a condition which causes young children to age rapidly, and they rarely live past sort of 15, 16. But they have an over-large head, no hair, no body hair. Their sexual organs are extremely small. And in some cases, they have an extra finger, which is called polydactylism. And a lot of those symptoms are actually, if you look at the alien autopsy film, extremely similar. Now, and I'm not endorsing the film, but I'm just, it's kind of like an eerie thing that, you know, that it actually does, the body or the model or the dummy, whatever you want to call it, does actually mirror, you know, the whole issue of what somebody with progeria looks like. And even more intriguing, I actually found files from Oak Ridge, which is where this elderly lady I mentioned at the beginning worked. I got files from Oak Ridge through the Freedom of Information Act showing that in the summer of 47, a young boy with progeria was actually subjected to a radiation experiment in 47 to determine if there was a way to sort of lessen his progeria, to slow it down. Now, that was, you know, undertaken for a good reason, but it is intriguing that, you know, this issue of progeria and Oak Ridge and the summer of 47 actually come together in declassified official files.
Yeah, very interesting. Me and Cam actually were lucky enough to actually hold the Starchild skull, and I think that's probably what that is. And Pro Jerry, I never put. Thank you for putting two to two together, because I think Cam has that. He's got a big head, small wedding tackle. So I think you cleared something up today.
It's true. It's true.
Hey, I know you're really busy, and thanks for taking time to talk to us today. Tell folks where they can get the book.
Okay, well, the book's called The Roswell UFO Conspiracy, and you can order it online at Amazon, or if you like going in Barnes & Noble, you can order it from them, and they can get it in about 2 or 3 days.
So. That's awesome. I'll put links to all that in the show notes. Thanks so much, Nick, for coming on.
All right, thanks, guys. Thanks a lot.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Man, it's always fun to have Nick on, right? I mean, guy can just talk and talk and talk. He knows so much. He's written so much. I mean, everybody always makes the joke about how many books the guy writes, and because it does seem like that. But he actually told me that they just came out in a row really quickly. He'd been writing
He works on them, but the way he's turned them in and all that, they just happen to be released like this.
Yeah, and he tries to treat his work day like a normal person. He works from home, but I mean, he works 9 to 5, and when he tells me when it's 5 o'clock, he turns off the computer. And he's done for the day, but he's grinding. So you can only imagine, if you're working 8 hours a day every day, you could probably write a lot of books. I mean, he works harder than any other author I know.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of the, well, like we talked about, that's what he does. So he puts the grind in. And what's funny is we have to be real careful whenever we get Nick in here or when we get him on air with us, because if we'll turn off and stop recording of this, and then we may still talk another hour and a half, 2 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things that I can't stop talking to him, and we even discussed it. We're going to have to go over there and hang out. You know, we need to go over there and just chit chat with Nick, because it's been a while since we got to hang out and just have a few drinks and just talk, just us. No recording, no nothing, just chilling.
So right.
We're going to definitely have to go do it. But yeah, he grinds, and I don't, like I was giving him a hard time. I don't know how he keeps it all
straight in his head.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
Because, I mean, we've only been doing the show for 4 years, and there's still times where I think of something. I'm like, man, did we talk about that, or did we just read that?
Yeah.
You don't know, because we talk about so many paranormal things.
Yes.
It kind of runs together sometimes. But, you know, his new book, this Roswell UFO conspiracy book, he's going to catch a lot of flack over this, I think, and we kind of talked about it, but...
Well, he did the first time when he wrote The Body Snatchers in the Desert.
Uh-huh.
That's where it first started rocking the boat. And
I mean,
this one may, because we've got the anniversary of Roswell coming up.
It's an iconic case. That's the problem.
Yeah, it's one of those things that people are kind of married to their ideas on it.
Yeah, and just like we talk about the Patterson-Gimlin film, where I'm back and forth. Roswell, to me, I mean, I've read some of Nick's theories before, and well as some others. If I have to be in a camp, I have to be in the non-believer camp. I don't think it truly was a UFO that crashed there. I don't.
This feels like it has a lot of validity to it. You know what it is for me is this. I don't know that I'm in a camp yet. I don't know that I can pick exactly what I feel like. I'm willing to look at any new information they bring forward because I want to, but I can't make up my mind on it, because it's just like Patterson-Gimlin. There's some days that I'm like, man, that was extraterrestrial. That's where all this has come from. And then there's other days that I'm like, man, the government was testing stuff on people and they fooled some of their people. So they let the people they fooled that work for them go ahead and tell their stories and just build disinformation. There's just so much. It drives me crazy to try to, I guess I just can't go, that's what I'm going to go with. It's just too much for me.
I just don't think it was a UFO. I just don't. For whatever reason, I think it was some kind of top secret military aircraft that went down, whether it a balloon.
Now, what you're saying, though, you're not saying you don't believe in there might be anything extraterrestrial. You're not saying that. You're just saying you don't think that one case was extraterrestrial.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think aliens exist. I do. And UFOs, too. I just think that crash was not an extraterrestrial craft. I think it crashed in the middle of the desert near Los Alamos, where they know they were testing aircraft like this. It was discovered by a farmer, you know, Mac Brazel and the Proctor boy that was riding with them. They were looking for sheep while mending fences and stuff. They didn't know what they were looking at. And if there was strange writing on there, I mean, that could easily be Japanese writing or just symbolism from like types of tape that I've read. You know, I've read all kinds. Yeah. Everybody's familiar with the theories. I just don't think it was a UFO crash for whatever reason. But interesting nonetheless. Nick, I would, if you're into this kind of thing, if you're into UFOs, if you're into Roswell, that type of thing.
If you're listening to this show, you are.
Right. You should pick up Nick Redfern's books. I mean, all of them. I have, it's funny, I said I want to get the complete Nick library, but I think I've got about 15 of his books.
He needs to offer that in a box set.
Yeah.
Right? Put a box set together of the complete library. Of course, it'd probably weigh about 250 pounds. It'd be hard to ship it, but... And I would suggest, if you're going to buy this book, his new book, for sure do it. But I would also suggest getting The Body Snatchers in the Desert. Get both so you can kind of get the buildup of the time, of the way it's been laid out. It's kind of like when they did Magicians, or I'm sorry, Fingerprints of the Gods with Graham Hancock, and then he revisited it with Magicians of the Gods. It's kind of something you want to lay the groundwork down,
yeah,
to get into this idea. And it's also, I would tell you something to do this. Watch online what's fixing, what as this stuff starts coming out with the new Roswell and all that, or I mean, with the new Roswell, with the Roswell stuff coming up, we'll see how that all goes, because like there's gonna be a lot of people really enjoy it, and there's gonna be, like you said, there's gonna be some people probably gonna hate it. So let's see how that turns out.
Right, so let's talk about our sponsors real quick. Don't forget about Gaia.com. that's Gaia.com/expanded perspectives. Gaia is a video streaming service with over 7,000 titles, ad-free, of course. You can go over there and check them out. They're pretty cool. They got all kinds of films and documentaries. They have a Seeking Truth category, Transformation category, yoga, things like that. They have incredible shows over there, and I suggest you go over there. They got one-of-a-kind shows like Open Minds with Regina Meredith, Cosmic Disclosure with Corey Good and David Wilcock, Missing Links with Greg Braden, Beyond Belief with George Norrie, Hidden Origins with Michael Tellinger, and of course, Truth Hunters with Linda Moulton Howe, mm-hmm, and many more. I mean, it's really cool. I really like the deep space.
I'm getting into the yoga videos. I'm not joking around. I've been trying it. You know what I mean? Like, uh-huh, dabbling my toe because it's just there. So I've been getting into the yoga videos because I'm like, I'm a little embarrassed to go to yoga because I'm really not the yoga like type, and I don't want to be. I want to be decent at something before I go right into a class. Does that make sense?
No, I understand what you're saying.
I don't want to look foolish. So I do. And, you know, I like it. I like having that at my fingertips.
A lot of people I know that do it like it. They talk about, you know, for a long time, yoga was something that seemed like only women did.
Yes.
But I think more and more guys are getting into it.
I enjoy it.
Every guy I know that's ever attempted it said they feel better. They feel like they have less stress.
And it's a beating.
Yeah.
Dude, it's a shocker. But, yeah, I mean, I appreciate Guy for having that.
Yeah, well, Gaia has three great offers at one amazing experience. They have a three-month plan, a monthly plan, and an annual plan. And if you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. But you got to use our promo code, people. You have to go to Gaia.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, Gaia.com/expanded perspectives.
Not just that, Philly, but also don't forget about ZipRecruiter, y'all. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes.
That's right.
And also find where they can find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results.
That's right.
So right now, folks, if you're ready for this, the listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. If you just go to ZipRecruiter.com/expanded. It's ZipRecruiter.com/expanded, and you can go try it for free.
That's right. And Blue Apron. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/expanded. Cam, what do you got planned for your week?
My week is going to consist of a lot of work crammed into a very small amount of time because I'm going to be going on my river trip this coming Friday.
That's right.
So I'll go leave Friday morning. I'll go down halfway down the river. My son and I'll camp, and we're going to fish the whole way, of course, and all that. And I am going to video it, and I'll end up turning it into a video, and I will post it on our YouTube channel just for grins for all the listeners to check out what we do whenever we're not doing the show. We'll start throwing some of those out there because we haven't had time to make a lot of videos.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know what we'll start doing? We'll start adding a few of those here and there. But yes, I'm going to be doing a whole lot of that to get stuff ready and get all my gear packed and get everything that I need to get going. And I'm assuming that you're going to be doing a lot of baseball.
Yeah, we got another baseball tournament this weekend, so that's what we're going to be doing. Hopefully we do well.
Do they have any games this week?
Thursday, I believe.
Thursday. Where's this one going to be? Do you know the Metroplex somewhere?
I think this one is in Weatherford.
Woohoo!
I think.
Well, I know what I'm doing Thursday then.
Right? I hope so. That would be nice.
That would be very nice. So, yeah, looks like I'll be there Thursday. And, folks, real quick, before you go anywhere, all you elitists, we got a surprise for y'all. As we were talking, I wish we were talking. As we were talking about Nick and how we like to chat with Nick, and when we get off, you know, air, we seem to keep going. Well, we didn't quit recording this time. We kept going.
That's right.
And Nick kept going, and we just kept digging into more stuff about Roswell, more stuff about his other books of shapeshifters that are coming out. He's also talking about a secret book that's going to be released right after the first of the year that nobody knows about.
That's right.
He's going to be chatting about. So for all you elitists, you're going to get that on Friday. For those of you that aren't an elitist, that's a whole other reason to sign up for just $5 a month, folks.
That's right. Go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. Click on the Elite tab. Signing up is easy. You just do it through PayPal. It's $5 a month. You'll get an additional show every week, as well as access to the entire back catalog, about 150 episodes. What a deal for $5. Don't miss out. If you have a story you'd like to share with us, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call the show 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media, and we hope to hear from you soon. For Pretty Lights, Inner Tradition, New Page Books, Llewellyn Books, Anomalous Books, and Ancient American Magazine, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.